Good morning and welcome to the October 18th, 2021 meeting of the Chelan Public Utility District Board of Commissioners. We're meeting primarily in virtual fashion due to the COVID, and I know there are some people in the boardroom, but we five commissioners are all on and all there virtually. Staff in the office today, is my understanding, is Rebecca Newman, Clerk of the Board, Eric Walquist, General Counsel, and Kirk Hudson sitting in as interim, not interim, but acting General Manager this morning for this morning's meeting. Due to COVID, we are meeting remotely, and while normally I would remind everyone to silence their cell phones, I still would like you to do that, especially when you are speaking on any topic, when you unmute your Microsoft Teams, phones have a tendency to ring right at that moment in time. And speaking of that, please do remain on mute unless you're speaking, because we get feedback, background noise, and it just helps the conduct of the meeting. We do value public input at our meetings, and we'll be providing an opportunity for the public to have input at the end of our morning session and at the end of our afternoon session. And if you do wish to speak, we ask that you provide your name and address for the record, as our meetings are recorded, and we would wish to have an accurate record of your input. At this time, we will have our Pledge of Allegiance and Safety Minute brought to us today by Devin Howell. Devin?
Thank you. Yes, Devin Howell. I'm the Manager of Technology Development and Innovation, and I'll lead us in the pledge. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Yes, for this morning's safety minute, I want to take a minute and express gratitude to the district for our commitment to safety. For myself personally, I work in the office, and although it has benefited me, the things that I've learned about safety, I would say that many of the things that I've learned have been much more of a benefit outside of the office and in my everyday life. I just wanted to share a couple of examples. My wife and I, we have a side business where we teach firearm instruction, and we've always had a focus on hearing protection and eye protection. But through the efforts of our safety department, that's really been brought to a greater awareness for me. You know, the hearing tests that we do when we come on site, and when we leave the district, you see the difference in your hearing over those years. That really brought an awareness to me of protecting my hearing and those people that I work with. We even go to the extent of, you know, foam earplugs inside of the earmuffs that we wear, because once you're aware of that hearing loss, once it's gone, it's gone. It's there in your mind always. And you know, whenever I'm using the lawnmower, using my circular saw, just those principles that are taught are always being brought back into my memory. And I think, what would Dave Parkhill want me to do in this situation? And so I appreciate those efforts. And whenever my son starts at the lawnmower, I'm watching to see, now is he wearing his earmuffs? And those principles are being passed down from generation to generation, and it's going to be a great benefit in the, not just the short term, but in the long run. And so I wanted to say thank you to the district for your efforts and dedication to safety, both in the office and outside the office.
Thank you. That's very, very valuable to hear, that us taking safety seriously in-house translates to a changing lifestyles, and I completely agree with you that I've picked up so many tips over the years on safety that I would not have otherwise thought of. So thank you for the thanks.
Yeah, I think we need to be a little careful here of giving Parkhill too much credit, because then we'll have to live with him right after that. The second thing is, Devin, what I really appreciate is you know, the influence outside of work. And I was watching our major news outlet for the state of Washington, and they were covering a blowdown area in a neighborhood, and they showed this gentleman cleaning up his yard with a chainsaw. No eye protection, no ear protection, no chaps, no gloves, nothing. Just out there chewing away, you know, on his fall down in his yard. And I thought, he'd never get away with that. You can tell he doesn't work a Swan County PUD. But it just, it carries over. And, you know, things you see, things you think about, and you're exactly right, and thanks for pointing it out.
Commissioners, any other comments? Well, thank you again, Devin. We much appreciate your safety minute.
Thank you.
Commissioners, item two on the agenda is the approval of the agenda. And as soon as I get my pen working again, I guess I won't. But it's been recommended that from the regular agenda, the resolutions 12, 13, 14, and 15 all be moved to the consent agenda. Is there any objection to moving those to the consent agenda? If there's no objection, we will move them to the consent agenda. And at this time, if there's anybody in the audience that is not staff that wishes to speak to any agenda item today, rather than waiting until the end of our meeting for public input, I would take those requests for the board to consider at this time. Hearing no requests, we'll move on to item three on the agenda, and that's the balanced scorecard update. And Rebecca, I did not print that out, but I know there was only a couple of exceptions that are not yet complete. And we commissioners have gotten into the process of reporting items that are not yet complete or likely not to be completed. And the first one is Commissioner Congdon on attendance at quarterly mid-commissioner managers meetings.
Let me catch up. I just went and found a power cord. I mean, an extension cord. So I could,
well, so I could, I'll share with you.
Again, battery again.
We haven't had a mid-C meeting this year as a result of COVID. And that's... and so that's likely.
There's my report. Thank you, Randy.
You bet.
That's all we need. Thank you.
Okay. And then the only, and Rebecca's scrolling down to right there. I think that's Commissioner Bowles. I want to scroll back up just a little bit. I can't see the reporter. Oop, it's me. Okay, that's our budget.
I'm feeling better.
Yeah. We are today we will take another step in our budget process, and by December I anticipate we will turn that from white to green. And so the budget will be is scheduled to be approved in early December, and we will be through that in our balanced scorecard. Now we're coming up on the only red block, and Commissioner McKenna, I don't know if you have that in front of you or not. And that has to do with attendance at NWPPA for the annual conference. If you don't have that in front of you, let me know and I can help you out. I think you're on mute. Well, in essence, the NWPPA conference did not provide a virtual option in this year, and none of our commissioners traveled for that conference. So that one may ultimately end up in the red for the year.
Yeah, Randy, this is Ann. Yes, so they did not. I think I misled everybody. It looked like early on, it looked like they were going to provide a virtual option. And so Gary signed up and I signed up. But at the last minute, I was able to find out that they decided it just wouldn't be effective. So they didn't do a virtual option. And they had, remember, their attendance was low, understandably. But, you know, hopefully we'll all attend next year.
Okay. Thank you, Ann. Appreciate that. Mm-hmm. And then, once again, the last item that is, or an item that's under my purview that has not been yet completed, is the appointment of two members for the upcoming year for the audit committee. And that's traditionally, over the last several years, we've asked the president and vice president, whomever that may be, come January 1, to be those representatives to the audit committee. So that will get completed at the end of the year. Thank you, Rebecca. At this time, I'll turn the conduct of the meeting over to Kirk Hudson to start down our normal business items.
Good morning, commissioners. Kirk Hudson, Managing Director of Generation and Transmission and Acting General Manager this morning. Item number four on your agenda is the 2022 budget targets and major assumptions. This is the next step in the budgeting process, translating from the business plans to a proposed budget for your review. The discussion this morning is focused on underlying assumptions, and you'll start seeing budget numbers in November. With that, I'll turn it over to Mark Mullins.
Great. Thank you, Kirk. And thank you, Rebecca. Quick sound check. Can everybody hear me okay?
We can hear you fine.
Very good. Thank you. Good morning, commissioners. This is Mark Mullins, Director of Enterprise Planning, Risk, and Analytics. And today I'll be presenting the 2022 budget kickoff presentation, and this is a presentation regarding our timeline and key assumptions. So what we're going to cover today is our purpose, timeline, guidelines, and assumptions, and next steps. There is no board action required today. As Kirk mentioned, we won't be presenting the actual numbers, but really just kicking off and transitioning from the business planning process. So we'll just be focusing on some of those assumptions. But no numbers today. That'll come up at our first public hearing in November. So today, we're focusing on transitioning from the five-year business planning effort that was for the period 2022 through 2026 and transitioning to the annual budget process. And this will focus specifically on the first year of that five-year business plan, 2022. And just a quick refresher on our annual planning cycle. It all starts with the district's mission and vision. And from there, we develop our, with a lot of customer owner outreach, our district strategic plan, the most recent being 2020 through 2024. We have four strategic goals that's aligned with that strategic plan. And originally, seven strategic objectives. And through this year's business planning cycle, we've added an eighth strategic objective, fostering a culture of serving the public interest. And we've had that intertwined throughout our initiatives and balanced scorecard and strategic initiatives, but we wanted to call this out as our eighth strategic objective. From there, the senior management team engaged in a priority setting session to develop our first draft of the priorities for our five-year business plans. And then we developed our district-wide five-year business plan. Once we finalize that first draft, then the different operating units and the managing directors and the business advisors develop their business unit five-year business plans. And that brings us where we are here today, focusing on the 2022 annual budget. From there, once the budget is approved, we'll develop our district-wide annual performance plan. And that gets reported to the board on a quarterly basis. So there's transparency around our progress what we're doing well, what we're falling behind on, and just as we do for our 2021 performance plan as well, we'll continue that into next year. From there, we'll develop our department work plans and then our annual employee performance plans, which also includes their individual development plans. The whole purpose of this cascading effect is to ensure everybody's aligned and we're all focusing on the strategic plan and those four strategic goals. From a timeline perspective, as you heard at the October 4th meeting, Steve Wright, our general manager, and the managing directors presented the five-year business plan. Today, we'll kick off the budget process with this overview and assumptions presentation. We'll have two public hearings on November 1st and November 15th, and then we'll come back to the board on December 6th requesting approval of that budget. From a strategic focus perspective, the 2022 budget is built around the strategic initiatives that you heard about in the business planning presentations on October 4th, 2021. The foundation of our strategic initiatives and at the top of our balanced scorecard is customer owner satisfaction. So this budget for 2022 will have key focuses around our customer owners. The district initiatives are identified to accomplish our strategic plan goals, as mentioned, and this board this budget cycle does require by board resolution that we include an annual budget and also a five-year financial plan compliant with our district's financial policies. This is a slide that you've seen several times in the past, so I won't spend a lot of time on it, but these are the four strategic plan goals that align with our strategic plan: investing in assets and people, financial resiliency, enhancing the quality of life in Chelan County, and engaging in economic development. And I'll go into each of these a little bit more on the next four slides. So you'll see a little bit of overlap from what you heard at the last board meeting on the five-year business plans, but this is specifically focusing on 2022 with our first goal, investing in assets and people. We want to move towards that 89% capability and achieving that by Q1 of 2025. So 2022 is going to see some significant hydro spending for our modernization projects, both at Rock Island, Powerhouse 1 and 2, and also Rocky Reach. This budget will include some increased spending to offset some of the impacts of our wildfire risk mitigation. We do have a goal to be in the first quartile for distribution reliability, but through prudent wildfire risk mitigation and other impacts and uncertainties, we may need to spend a little bit more money through contract work and others to achieve that first quartile goal. In 2022, we're also going to see significant spending on our long-term facilities, Rocky Reach and Central Maintenance, but also our Operations and Service Center, which you've all seen is making great progress. And these will ultimately add additional value for our customer owners through the efficiencies that we'll gain through those facilities. We'll continue to advance our human performance and safety culture and leveraging technology to help improve in some of those indicators that we're getting from a safety perspective, with the ultimate goal of being in that first quartile. We've also talked about the fire safety outage management program with a pilot in 2021. We'll continue to expand on that as we mitigate wildfire risk to protect our public as well as our property and assets. And we'll continue moving forward on our technology roadmaps, focusing on delivering incremental customer owner value. And as mentioned, we invest in our employees through skill development and growth opportunities, leveraging the individual development plan where we can identify skills that we'd like to continue to develop, technical skills, soft skills, leadership skills, as we continue to move forward and achieve our strategic objectives. Our second goal is financial resiliency. So we've developed strong financial metrics to support our strong AA rated entity. And our financials are strong, and you'll see that reflected in the 2022 budget. You've heard earlier this year on our long-term marketing strategy, diversifying our portfolio around our cost-based contracts and market-based contracts. And we're seeing some significant opportunities to secure long-term revenue as there's a demand for our carbon-free resources. We have a strong cash balance, and it gives us flexibility to adapt, and that also provides us with the ability to maintain our low debt leverage over time as we continue to implement on our capital programs. So this budget for 2022, there will be significant expenditures, and we kick that off with the 2022 through 2026 business planning process. We are still expecting to issue debt in 2023 as we draw down on our cash to support the capital program. And we do have annual rate increases June 1st in 2022 with this budget, but also through 2024, which is part of our strategic plan for 2020 through 2024, as identified there. Our third goal, public power benefit. So our financial forecasts are indicating a $6 million level that will continue. The board has approved projects for 2022 that will return incremental value to the community, accelerating fiber expansion to reach more people in our county, investing in our parks, extending the Loop Trail and Riverfront Park, but also improving the aesthetics for substations as well. We do have $1.5 million remaining for 2022 projects. So through the solicitation processes, there may be some good ideas coming forward that will be brought in front of the board for consideration at a future date. And our fourth goal, economic development. Significant investment around distribution, substations, and infrastructure to help support our reliability goal, but also the growth that we're expecting too. We do have our largest retail load expecting to ramp up in 2022, and they're also wanting to expand their operations as well. And which is one reason we've seen a lot of activity in the market and a lot of interest in our carbon resource in Chelan County. We've developed a marketing strategy and a generation portfolio that is well positioned to adapt to changing circumstances with the goal of supporting economic development with no more than 5% rate impact to our customer owners. So from a financial policies perspective, I'll just cover some August 2021 metrics, just to give you a sneak peek of the metrics that we're seeing when we get to the first public hearing and start presenting our budget numbers, or at least our initial numbers. That'll reflect the Q3 forecast, which you'll actually hear earlier in the day on November 1st as we present the Q3 update. But just a sneak peek on August 2021. So we are meeting all of our four financial metrics around liquidity, combined cover, debt ratio, and days cash on hand. Some early indicators for 2022, COVID-19, we're presenting virtually, so that uncertainty continues to remain today. We are seeing some supply chain risks that continue to evolve, and we'll adapt to those as we go. The wholesale electric market remain strong. Capacity and carbon prices are strong, and we're seeing some energy prices that are also strong that will be reflected in the 2022 budget. However, just as a reminder, those energy prices can be volatile. They can move up and they can move down. But at this point in time, we're seeing some strong opportunities there. From a technology reorganization, we continue to advance on our strategy that you've heard about, ensuring that we have the proper level of focus on our cyber strategy, and we'll continue to advance those technology roadmaps to add incremental value for our customer owners. As mentioned, we have flexibility in our portfolio to adapt for that increasing large load potential that is out there that could escalate beyond our expectations around system load growth. And as you heard about last June, when Ron Gibbs presented on the insurance program, wildfire risk will continue to impact insurance premiums and potentially coverage. We did get some good feedback from our underwriters that our wildfire mitigation programs are the right direction, and incremental spending in those areas is really important to that and maintaining that coverage that we desire. So quickly looking at some of the 2022 budget assumptions on the wholesale revenue, we have a historical database around water. So we'll budget based on average water, as well as our current forward energy prices and carbon price curves. Our hedge program is fully implemented and continuing, and we'll include planned unit outage impacts as well that impacts our generation numbers, along with the fish spill requirements that we want to integrate in there as well. From a system load growth perspective, we have some preliminary numbers that indicate 6.1% electric load growth. 11 average megawatts of that is related to our largest retail local load. From an organic growth perspective, 0.7%, at least for a preliminary assumption. 2% water and 1.5% wastewater assumptions on system load growth. And then 1,100 new fiber connections, 750 in our current service territory, and then 350 new connections related to the public power benefit program. Business line service revenues, we do have our increases included as part of our strategic plan. That'll be implemented on June 1st of 2022, and then again each June 1st thereafter through 2024, 3% electric and 3% fiber, and 4% water and wastewater. Looking at our assumptions around labor, bargaining unit increases are continuing to be negotiated. Our non-bargaining unit, we do have some assumptions around merit increases, market adjustments and promotions, but ultimately those final numbers will be impacted by actual market data. And we're continuing to use our maximum levels in our long-term cost-plus power contract, so no changes there in this budget cycle. As mentioned, capital and operating expenditures are driven by the 22 through 2026 business plan. We have some significant spending in 2022, particularly around Rock Island modernization and Rocky Reach, large units and small units as well, distribution substation and infrastructure, and vegetation management. And also long-term facilities, operations and service center, and Rocky Reach Central Maintenance are key drivers. We are planning scheduled principal payment reductions of $34 million plus a six-month accelerated payment of $12 million and interest earnings estimated at 2.22%. Also on our public power benefit program includes $6 million annually as part of our accelerated fiber expansion and other board selected projects and designated funding levels. The full amount will be budgeted for, and then as those projects are designated, then we'll transfer that money to those specific projects. So for next steps, we'll continue to develop and work in our preliminary budgeting process. As mentioned, we'll have public hearings on November 1st and November 15th, and then we'll come back to the board on December 6th requesting board approval. And with that is our budget overview and setting the stage for the public hearings, and at this point, I'll take any questions.
Commissioners, questions? It certainly appears this next year is going to be a very big capital program year.
Yes, it will be a large capital program, and as we've seen in the past, we've presented the 2021 budget was also a robust capital program, but we'll continue to see that into 2022 with these key projects that we have coming forward.
But it's also nice to see some of those projects being brought to conclusion.
Yes.
It really is. The new center, the new facility at Rock Island, we dedicated that. That was really nice to see something completed.
Yep, absolutely. That's an incredible facility, definitely.
If I can say something, I just would like to once again congratulate the finance department. Great report. Tremendous news on our budget. And I'd also like to make the comment that there is no better time to do capital modernization than when your revenues are adequate to support it. And we've had some great, a couple of great years in finance and money coming in, and that money is being well placed to complete these capital projects. So I'm really pleased. We're in a good position. It didn't just happen. A lot of thought and effort went into this, and the finance department has a lot to do with that. So thank you all very much, and make sure that you pass that on to all your staff.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. I appreciate that, and I will pass that on.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Commissioner Smith. Mark, I have a question. The format in which the presentation was made today, is this a revitalized one, a new one, presented a bit differently than previous?
No, this is real similar to how we presented this in the past. As I mentioned, it's our annual planning process.
I just thought it was really clear and very direct, and I appreciated it. Nicely done.
Thank you for that feedback. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah.
Commissioners, any other thoughts or comments or questions? Is there any member of the public on the phone that wishes to ask any questions? Hearing none, thank you very much, Mark. Great presentation.
Thank you, Commissioners. We'll see you on November 1st.
Okay.
The next item on the agenda is agenda item number 5. Each year, we try to give the board a presentation on areas Treasury is looking at to coincide with the proposed following year's budget. With that, I'll turn it over to Heather Ireland.
Thanks, Kirk. Quick sound check. Am I coming through?
Can hear you just fine.
Great, thank you. Good morning, commissioners. This is Heather Ireland. I'm the lead treasury analyst for the district. It's the time of year, obviously, when we are in the midst of budget season. And as Kirk mentioned, we do typically come to you with some updates regarding our cash, investment, and debt portfolios. Taking that opportunity today to share some information only. At this time, for Treasury-related items, no action is being requested, but as we'll discuss, you'll likely see us back later this year or early next year with some requests that will require some action from the board. But today, just information only. So today, if we can go to the next slide, just for a quick overview of what we're going to cover. First item on the agenda is going to be a follow-up of our new board designated fund for electric rate support. A couple of other items we're going to cover are the traditional annual update on our financing plans related to our debt portfolio, as well as a heads up on a few upcoming items. To start with though, cash and investments first. The first item is in 2020, the board adopted an electric rate plan, which was included in the 2020 through 2024 strategic plan. That was adopted by a resolution 214424. And that resolution directed staff to establish a commission designated fund for the purpose of holding incremental electric revenues from that rate action for future rate stabilization. And deposits were intended to be made to that board designated fund on an annual basis. The first electric revenues began to be billed and collected in December of 2020, and we're now at the point where annual deposits into the board designated fund will begin to occur. To create a process for how that would happen, we met with a group of representatives from Treasury, Accounting, Strategic Financial Planning, and Customer Utilities to determine how we could do an annual calculation and deposit that would be a process we could maintain each year. Our current plan is that in each December, the total of electric rate revenue will be multiplied by the approximate average incremental rate increases that were previously approved by the board through resolution 214424. That first deposit will be recorded in December of 2021, so upcoming here in just a month or two. We're currently estimating that that first deposit will be approximately $2.5 million based on year-to-date revenues and forecast for the remaining year. And then to ensure visibility around that balance, beginning with your year-end board quarterly financial review that will be presented after the close of 2021. The fund balance will be reported each quarterly board review. So you'll see that probably in February of 2022, as that should be the first time that there's a quarterly financial review presented to the board. Our next steps will include focusing on how potentially the funds could be used or drawn in the future. For phase one of this project, we really focused this fall on just ensuring we had a process to begin the annual deposits. And phase two will be working with the senior team and the board to create some framework and parameters around the future use of the funds. So we'll be back in 2022 for that. The other item, treasury related topic about cash and investments, is just kind of a heads up for the board that expect to see us again this spring, possibly in Q1 of 2022, in regards to our investment and banking resolution. We do an annual review of that policy, and due to staffing changes and anticipated staffing changes that we foresee upcoming over the next quarter or two, we'll likely be back for a request for signer updates. The other topics I wanted to talk about this morning include our debt portfolio. And one of the things we do each year is we come to the board to provide an overview of our near-term action plans as well as our longer-term action plans. The district's internal asset and liability committee reviews the district's financial forecast and monitors our projected external and internal funding needs routinely. And then from that information, we build a recommended operational plan of finance to share with the board annually. So this summary on this slide is the external view of that plan. We continue to anchor to the board-affirmed long-term debt philosophy to manage debt to create financial flexibility that supports low and stable electric rates, even if lower than expected financial results are experienced. And this operational plan of finance really is the how we're able to do that. It translates that philosophy and planning strategies into forecasted actions to meet those objectives with optimal results and in the best interests of our customer owners. For 2022, the detailed action plan is included in our five-year business plans and the 2022 budget. So this is one of the assumptions that you'll be seeing in the budget as that process moves forward. We are planning to continue our scheduled principal payments, and then also a slight acceleration by just 6 months of certain payments to achieve some savings and support our debt service cover. We've done that for a number of years and had really good results from that process. Beyond 2022, our general and broad steps in the future, again, include those continued planned payments and gradually issuing new debt for long-lived assets, likely every few years for efficiency. And you can see, even with those new issuances included in our plans, we still expect to have a gradual decline in our overall debt balances through the end of this forecast window. And our next new debt issuance is planned, as Mark mentioned in the last presentation, still planned for 2023. So moving off of the external view of the plan, again, no external issuances planned for 2022. But we will always continue to monitor market opportunities. In addition, we also look at the individual system needs to ensure that every individual system at the district has the cash that they need to achieve their plans. For 2022, we have no forecast for internal loan needs as well, but we will continue to monitor those capital project schedules. If for some reason we have an acceleration of some of our capital plans, we could certainly have a need occur, but we'll monitor those and we'd come back to the board if anything like that occurred where we needed action. But as of right now, not anticipating any 2022 internal loans. Another debt-related item that I do anticipate seeking board approval for in the next few months is what we refer to as an SBPA, which is an acronym for a standby bond purchase agreement. The district does have one issue of variable rate bonds that are outstanding. Those are our 2008B bonds, and they have a reset of an interest rate every 7 days. In order to successfully remarket or resell these bonds every 7 days, market participants expect that there's a form of liquidity support attached to the bonds. That's where we use a standby bond purchase agreement or an SBPA. That agreement is between the district and a bank. And what it basically does is that if for some reason the bonds can't be resold in the market, the bank will step in and purchase the bonds. And then the district would be able to pay those bonds off over a specified period of time with the agreement with the bank. SBPAs routinely need to be renewed or replaced. And we're at that point in time. Our existing SBPA expires in July 2022, and we're working on options to ensure that we have a favorable solution that will support the variable rate bonds beyond that date. Ultimately, the board will be asked to consider approving a resolution to authorize the district to enter into either an extension or a new agreement. And we're targeting likely in early 2022 or possibly even before then that we would have an agreement in place that we'd be ready for the board to consider. So expect to see Treasury back on that topic in the near future. So just a summary of today's items and what you'll be seeing from Treasury over the next few months is the standby bond purchase agreement. There will be a resolution that will be brought to the board to approve either an extension or replacement of that. Possibly Q1 or earlier, we may be back this fall or early winter. In addition, you'll see a resolution request to update authorized signers in our investment and banking policy, and that will likely be in the first quarter of 2022. And then later in 2022, we'll also have some discussion with senior management and the board regarding some framework and guidelines to establish for use of that electric rate support fund that the board designated to hold the incremental revenues from the rate actions approved in 2020. So with that, I wanted to pause and ask if there's any questions I can answer regarding any of these items.
Commissioners, any questions? Heather, while you're pondering. Oh, go ahead, Gary. Go ahead.
Thank you, Randy. Heather, I had a question on the SBPA. Can you maybe share with me the logic on using that type of an instrument in this low interest rate market?
Using the variable rate bonds or using the SBPA agreement?
Well, the variable rate bonds.
So the variable rate bonds have been a good asset liability management tool for the district over the years. The district has a number of bonds that are in a long-term fixed rate mode, and the district has a cash and investment portfolio that is more geared towards shorter term investment durations. So our investment and cash portfolio has an average duration of about 2.5 years. And our debt portfolio has a duration that's over 5 years. Having the shorter term variable rate bonds has allowed us to pull down the duration slightly on our long-term debt portfolio. So as short-term rate movements occur on our investment portfolio, we also have corresponding short-term movement on our debt portfolio. So our net interest expense, the combination of our interest earnings and our interest expense on our debt portfolio, tend to move better in the same direction. And it takes some volatility out of the two. So for example, if we have a decline in short-term interest rates on our earnings side of our investment and cash portfolio, we also have a decline in the variable rate we're paying on those bonds. So there's less downside when those movements occur on our cash investment portfolio. When our cash and investment portfolio is experiencing rising rates and we're getting higher returns on that portfolio, We also will experience rising rates on the short-term variable rate bonds, and we will have a higher expense, but the differential between the two will move more in tandem.
Okay. Thank you.
So, Heather, I noted in one of the slides, projected debt ratio out to 2030 was down to about 12%. As we move forward with the next few years of investment, the raw numbers attached to that 12% will probably be somewhat higher than they would be today. Our basis is moving upward, I'm assuming.
Yes, that's correct. And also just to point out that this this forecast is based on the Q2 financial forecast. And so when you see the Q3 financial forecast, these numbers could change slightly. So just, you know, kind of awareness there on the timing of these forecasts. But you're correct. Our asset base is increasing through time.
At the moment, quite rapidly. Commissioners, any other questions?
Great report.
Yes, it is. It is very, very clear, very understandable. Much appreciated that way.
Thank you.
Commissioners, any other questions, comments? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Heather. Our next item, agenda item number 6, is our integrated resource plan. You might recall we develop an integrated resource plan every 2 years. In this particular case, we're well ahead of schedule and actually choosing the timing of this update on the process with you to coincide with the clean energy implementation plan, which will be in item number 7. So you'll hear the connection between these two. With that, I'll turn it over to Becky Keating.
Good morning, commissioners and everyone. My name is Becky King. I'm senior analyst in energy planning and trading. Does everybody hear me fine?
Can hear you fine, Becky.
Okay, thank you. As Kirk mentioned, we're here today to talk about our 2021 integrated resource plan process. And there's no action being requested of the board today. As Kirk mentioned, we are changing our schedule a bit. We've always done them on the even year. We're now moving to odd year in the fall to line up with the Clean Energy Implementation Plan, which the first of those is due January 1st of 2022. And you mentioned Thule, we'll talk to you about that next. We're here today to talk about preliminary load forecast, as well as the district's net resource load position and our initial scenario results. There are many more topics that will be discussed in the IRP document that we're going to bring to you next month. Here's a look at our planned board and public process schedule for this year, bringing you initial portfolio analysis results today, tentatively coming back with our finalized portfolio analysis and our draft IRP document for your review on November 15th, and planning to come back with our final document, the resolution for your approval of the document on December 6th. And the IRP isn't actually due until next September. Since we're on this this new base year, we're ahead of schedule on that. Next slide, please. Our preliminary load forecast. So as we recall, our load forecast is made up of all of our sectors: residential, commercial, industrial, HDL, electric vehicles, and our little small irrigation, frost protection, et cetera. Our forecasts have, our low and base forecasts have increased some since the 2020 forecast, as you can see on the slide. And I want to address primarily why that is the load forecast, the low load forecast particularly, is that's more certainty in our larger largest retail load that Mark was referring to earlier, more certainty in their operations increasing. And as well as we have more certainty in some residential developments that were more in the planning process before that were that are now underway, as well as we expect to see some rebound in our commercial class that actually had been, we'd seen decreases in for 3 or 4 years. Expect to see a little bit of rebound in that. And you can see there our historical growth in the middle of the page there, 1.71%. And I apologize, I forgot to mention too, these load forecasts are gross forecasts, so they're before the effects of conservation, and we do that in IRP planning because conservation goes into IRP as a resource. So these are gross forecasts. And so our historical there, you can see in the middle of the slide, growth over the last average annual growth over the last 10 years, the 1.71%, net of conservation, 1.23%. And I'll also mention that for our I-937 compliance, we expect with our base load forecast net of conservation, we expect to need 31 to 35 average annual megawatts of incremental hydro to meet our requirement, renewable requirement under the I-937 over the planning period ending in 2030. Here's a graphical representation of those gross lower forecasts as well as the historical. And then this is a graphical representation of the district's resource position with those load forecasts overlaid. And so it's always a little bit of a challenge when you're not used to looking at this chart, but the blue represents our resource, the district's position, net of long-term contracts and executed short-term slices. And with low, average, and high water scenarios, like Mark was referring to earlier. And then the gray off to the left is what has already been sold off in terms of our short-term slice. And so then you see our load forecasts there from the previous slide overlaid on the district's position. So as in our previous IRPs, the district expects to, or that its current portfolio will meet its load and its renewable portfolio standard requirements through this planning period of, that ends in 2030. I want to note that the district is working on finalizing its conservation targets for this IRP right now. They might move around a little bit more, but we'll have that finalized for you when we come back in November. In terms of service reliability that we always look at in IRP planning, the districts, we expect that the districts will be able, with its load resource balance, to meet its hourly peak load monthly and its reserve requirements through the planning period. And I'll just note, too, the district is still heavily involved in the Northwest Power Pool's capacity resource planning effort right now, and it's moving, they're moving through their phases fairly quickly. And then as an environmental note for our portfolio, as you know, the district's resources, hydro and wind generating resources do not emit air pollutants. And we want to show everybody this slide. It's our public IRP website with the address there at the top of the page, and I circled below, there's a box that has a link in it for public participation, and the district invites public participation in its IRP process, and there's a link there that you can submit questions or comments, and the district will post presentations and the draft of the document as we go through this process and as they become available. So this presentation will be posted very shortly here, hopefully today, under the October 18th date. And does anybody have any questions?
Commissioners, any questions?
Yeah, I do have a quick one. So this will be posted, it says on the IRP website. So if you go to the regular website, schleinpud.org, then take me there from that website.
What I have done, sure, that's a good question. What I do when I go to our public website is I type in up in the search, and I'll just go there right now to make sure I'm saying this accurately. But I think if you just go into the search box, and type in IRP, I just want to make sure that works.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, okay, so there's our search. Okay.
What if you, I'm just thinking about people who wouldn't think to put in IRP. What if they just typed in resource plan? I've got your presentation up on my iMac, so I can't really do it right now from here.
Yeah, but let me try resource.
I guess I could play with it.
I just in the chat. I just this is Sean, managing director of Energy Resources. I just put a link to it there in the chat box.
Ah, all right.
Does that work for you?
Let me see here.
And that,
yeah, I see it. So no, that's great. I'm just thinking about the average Joe out there that's kind of interested in what we do and what our resources are and how we're going to meet certain conservation goals or whatever, you know, whatever people are interested in. And I'm just curious if it's going to be fairly easy for them to find it.
I'll just note, Anne, that I typed in resource plan, and it did come up with a nice direct link to it first thing at the top. So IRP, integrated resource plan, or resource plan, those all bring up it to the very top. And then we did note, too, in the newspaper ad that went out on September 25th, that there's at the bottom, we say that you can search on where to visit schleinpud.org and then to type in integrated resource plan, and then it'll pop right up. So we did try to address that in the advertising.
Good. That was what on the newspaper, what did you say it was, where it was?
Yeah, it was a display ad, a large display ad in the September 25th Wenatchee World.
Okay.
Any other commissioner questions? I'm getting some feedback, and I think it might be me, but I'm not sure. Becky, I do have one additional question. On our incremental hydro, refresh my memory, are we at the max level now of what's required by what was then the Initiative 937?
We are. We're at the 15%. We're at the max under the law.
Okay. When did we hit that max? Was it just a couple of years ago?
I think it was just 2020.
Okay. Very good. And we're still okay.
Yes. We are good through the planning period.
Okay, good.
When's the planning period? When is that planning period?
This IRP planning period is through 2030.
And then it most certainly will go up from there.
Well, but that that would have to pass in law, I think.
Correct.
Yeah. And Randy, you and I won't, we'll be on to other things by then.
Possibly. Okay. Any other questions for Becky? Thanks a lot. Now, Kirk promises that that Thule's presentation will tie into what we're just now talking about, right, Kirk?
Okay. Agenda item number 7, Clean Energy Implementation Plan. This is something new for us under the Clean Energy Transformation Act. And with that, I'll turn it over to Thule Hakala.
Thank you. Good morning. This is Thule Hakala, Energy Policy Advisor for the district. How's my audio sound?
Sounds great, Thule.
Good.
Thank you. Okay, yeah, so I've had a good lead up to this here. This is the Clean Energy Implementation Plan. This is the first of three presentations we have planned through the end of the year. Let's move to the next slide, please. Our goal today is to refresh our memories on what the Clean Energy Implementation Plan is, talk about the background, talk about the content that's going to be in the plan, and then talk about our next steps to the end of the year to make sure that we adopt the district's first plan by January 1st, 2022, when it's required. We're not asking for any board action today, just want to make sure that when we come back in November and December, we've got the background to make the decisions we need to make. Next slide. So the Clean Energy Implementation Plan, I'm going to call it CEIP. It's part of the Clean Energy Transformation Act, as Kirk mentioned. The first round is due by January 1st, 2022. And the point of the CEIP is to outline what a utility intends to do over the next 4 years to meet its CETA targets. As a refresher, CETA requires that utilities be coal-free by December 31st, 2025, greenhouse gas neutral by 2030, and greenhouse gas neutral means that you serve your load with at least 80% clean power and any amount that you're under 100%, but over 80%, you're offsetting with alternative compliance options. And then last, by 2045, utilities have to be 100% clean. And so the CEIP is looking at those targets, and depending on where you are between now and 2030 or between 2030 and 2045, you're outlining what steps you're taking during that four-year period to make sure that you're ready when 2030 or 2045 is here. Next slide. So the CEIP, kind of part of our larger planning process that we were just talking about through Becky's IRP presentation. So the IRP is looking out 10 years. The CEIP is looking out 4 years. And there is a part of the IRP, which is called the Clean Energy Action Plan. And that's also a CETA requirement, and that's also looking out 10 years. So if you think about the Clean Energy Action Plan and the Clean Energy Implementation Plan together, the action plan is that long-term 10-year look, and the CEIP is that 4-year near-term look. Next slide. All right, so let's dive into CEIP content. So the heart of the CEIP is setting targets and then identifying what actions you're taking during that 4-year period to meet those targets. So we have to set three different types of targets. The first is renewable energy targets. We have to set a target for the percentage of retail load that we expect to serve with renewable energy. And then based on that percentage target that we set, we also have to set a target that states our renewable energy target in terms of megawatt hours, total megawatt hours during that 4-year planning period. As a reminder, CETA considers traditional hydro to be renewable. So for the district, a way to think of this renewable energy target is it's a clean energy target. We also need to set a target for demand response and then a target for energy efficiency as well. And this is where we're making this process kind of easier on ourselves and easier on our customers and others who are following along, because we're using the same data inputs for the CEIP that we're using for the IRP. And so the two plans should mesh together well. And then after we've established those targets, we're outlining the actions that we're taking to meet those targets. So to give you an example, the action that we would call out for our renewable energy target is that we would be retiring RECs based on that renewable energy target to meet CETA compliance. We plan to come back in November, the November 15th meeting. We're going to have proposed targets and proposed actions outlined, and we'll share those with you at that time. All right, let's move to the next slide. CETA, in addition to meeting that 2030 GHG neutral requirement that I mentioned and a 2045 100% clean energy requirement, CETA also requires that utilities are ensuring that all customers are benefiting from Washington's transition to clean energy. And the heart of that intent section of the CETA is the CEIP's equity analysis. And the way that that is set out is utilities have to focus on two different types of communities. The first is highly impacted communities. And those are selected, identified for each utility by the Washington Department of Health. And so for the Chelan PUD service territory, we have one community that's been identified as a highly impacted community through the Department of Health's environmental disparities mapping effort, and that is a census tract located in central Wenatchee. In addition to highly impacted communities, utilities also need to consider what CETA calls vulnerable populations. And so compared to a highly impacted community, a vulnerable population might be a demographic community rather than a geographic community, like a census tract. And what CETA requires is that utilities work with their customers to identify vulnerable populations that are most relevant for their service territory, using socioeconomic and sensitivity factors. And then once those communities are identified, the utility, again, working with customers, needs to identify customer benefit indicators that are essentially metrics that the utility will use in their planning process to make sure that the customers really are benefiting from that transition to clean energy and benefits and burdens are equitably shared across their service territory. Again, we will have more specifics on this when we come back in November. We'll share our thoughts on vulnerable populations we should identify in our service territory, and then also customer benefit indicators. Let's move to the last slide, please. Okay, so next step. So we have, it's mid-October, and our first plan is due by January 1st, 2022, and this is how we intend to get there. So we are internally working on developing those targets and those actions, identifying vulnerable populations, customer benefit indicators. We'll come back in November, and we're going to present our current thinking on those items. And we'll have a final draft plan at that point. And then we'll come back in December for adoption of the plan, and we'll also be asking for authority to file that plan with the Department of Commerce. We have a number of opportunities for public comment and public participation. We have a website, which you can link to from the IRP website. The way that I tend to find it personally is I'll just go into Google, which is my preferred browser, and I just type in Chelan Clean Energy Implementation Plan, and that's the quickest way for me to find it. We have a email address set up specifically for CEIP. Okay, we don't have a specific email address just for the CEIP. It's our general Chelan PUD contact email. If you send us an email, we'll route it to the folks working on the CEIP. And we also have that email address linked on our CEIP webpage as well. We're always happy to take comment during board meetings. And we've already received feedback from the low-income advisory group. They provided some feedback on potential vulnerable populations and customer benefit indicators. And so we wanted to thank them for the time. We really appreciate that feedback. And that is all I have. So I'm happy to take questions and comments.
Commissioners, questions? Tuli, I seem to recall a few months ago that we had been monitoring areas of the county that are not energy stressed, but that have a higher energy burden, and that certain geographical areas popped up. Is that part of what you are doing in your implementation plan?
Commissioner, yes, there is a nexus there. And so one of the vulnerable populations that staff is considering identifying is exactly that, households that are energy burdened.
Yeah.
Okay. We're still thinking through that, though, and so I don't know if we'll come back with, anything on top of that, but that's certainly, I'd say, the main one we're considering for now.
Commissioner Smith, this is Andrew Griffin. So this is Andrew Grissell.
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So just a little more on that. So when, as you recall, we worked with the board to identify a low-income energy efficiency program. And when we were developing that program, we had this this sort of CETA implications and tie in mind. And so I think using that energy burden component to help identify the customers that need the most help. And so I think we're in a really good position and good place because of that work that we've already done on that as well. And then that same group that helped us to develop that program, that low-income advisory group, they've also been very good in helping us with some of these other components and pieces with regards to helping meet some of the stakeholder engagement process that's also needed within the within CETA and the CEIP.
Thank you. Commissioners, any other questions or comments? Good presentation. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Agenda item number 8, updated transmission practices and policies. You might recall that we've made it through setting the transmission rates, and Rob recently presented the interconnection agreements, and we've got this third piece of transmission practices and policies that Rob's going to provide background and information on and the process going forward. Take it away, Rob.
Thanks, Kirk. Good morning, Commissioners. Rob Davis, staff attorney with the district. As Kirk mentioned, we came to you this summer, gave you the appetizer, and we're back for the entree. We'll do this in sort of the same process we did last time. Give you a very high-level overview, some FERC history, some really just high-level touch points on the transmission practices themselves. We'll come back for another presentation with more detailed information, and then finally come to you for hopefully approval and acceptance. Even though this is high-level, though, feel free to pepper me with any questions you have at any level of detail. So, more specifically, why we're here today, we will review the initiatives that are underway and that have been completed. Talk about FERC tariff background. It's going to be more specific. specific to the transmission history than the interconnection history. And then we will talk about a few of the highlights in the policy itself. So there are our initiatives again. As Kirk noted, we have approved transmission rates. We have approved interconnection agreement templates. And this is the final piece. I do want to reemphasize, though, that as the team was going through all this work over the past few years, that this was being developed as a package. So these weren't developed in isolation. They really were a single package, and it was more circumstances that required us to bring them to you in the fashion we did. So don't want anyone to have the impression that there's potential for gaps or misalignment. This was really developed as a cross-district and integrated process. So jumping back into our background, this will be a review from our interconnection discussion, but it's a good place to start to remind us what we're doing and why we're doing it. So the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission is tasked with, among other things, preventing and remedying discrimination in transmission service and wholesale power marketing by investor-owned utilities. In 1992, they were given some more authority under the Energy Policy Act of 92 to take additional steps to address discrimination, including, in certain cases, by non-jurisdictional utilities. These new tools, however, were administered on a case-by-case basis and had some fair amount of process that had to be followed, and FERC found that it just wasn't getting there on the transmission side. And so in 1996, they adopted a pro forma open access transmission tariff. They required all jurisdictional utilities to provide open access to their transmission systems, and everyone had to use essentially the same transmission tariff to do it. This was, there were elements in there that were intended to incentivize non-jurisdictional utilities to adopt it as well. A number of LPPC members did at the time. We did not. Our situation and considerations made at the time led us not to do that. But in addition to some LPPC, other non-jurisdictionals like BPA and WAMP have also adopted it. So to the extent it's not required for non-jurisdictionals, it's still really an industry standard. And so there's that consideration as well for whether or not we want to adopt the tariff itself or elements of it. So over the years, FERC made a number of revisions, but there was still some concern that there might be discrimination in the use of transmission that needed to be remedied. So in the Energy Policy Act of 2005, Congress gave FERC additional powers, really simplified their ability to address discrimination. So FERC can now, by rule or order, require a utility to provide non-discriminatory transmission service. And the statutory language really isn't much more detailed than that. That's a simplification, but not much of one. So that is the world we live in, where even if for some reason we thought we wanted to use our transmission system in a way that disadvantaged competitors, it would be very easy for FERC to tell us not to. Fortunately, we aren't in that situation, and we're not staring down an adverse order from FERC, but it is something we need to be mindful of as we start getting more interest in how our system might be beneficial to third parties.
Rob, can I ask a question?
Yes, go ahead. Certainly.
Does this apply to Texas?
It does not apply to Texas because they separated themselves from the other interconnections.
Okay.
So it is no longer interstate transmission, which is where FERC has jurisdiction.
Okay, I just wanted to clarify that for my own mind. Thank you.
And there are some minor exceptions. I think NERC has some authority over Texas, so I'm not really clear where the line is, but generally this does not apply to them. So a lot more history here, and I included this primarily to show you some of the major changes that FERC has made over time to the pro forma tariff, give you an idea of what sort of things they were trying to address and how they did it. Their initial order 888, was what set the pro forma tariff and the requirement to use it. It was accompanied by another order that set up what's called the Open Access Same Time Information System, or OASIS. because along with the need for open access was the idea that any third party looking to use your system had to have the same access to information and applications and studies as everyone else. So those two things kind of went hand in hand. The other large elements we're going to talk about this morning regarding the open access transmission tariff were functional unbundling. This concept is that the transmission department of utility and the wholesale marketing department really needed to be separate from one another. FERC didn't go so far as saying they had to be separate affiliates, but did say you can't have your merchant folks going out and managing transmission, and you can't have your transmission people selling power because then you're in a position to use your system for your benefit and at the exclusion of your competitors. So that's really a key element of the open access framework. You see there under that bullet as well, I've got the word reciprocity, and this is one of the inducements that FERC put in for non-jurisdictional utilities. The concept is that a jurisdictional utility only has to offer service to a utility that will offer reciprocal service. And so this was intended to encourage non-jurisdictional utilities to also adopt the pro forma tariff so they can ensure continued service on the IOU systems under this framework of reciprocity. I don't know that anyone has been denied service under this, but it was an encouragement for a number of the non-jurisdictionals that adopted the tariff. And so you can file that with FERC. FERC will give you an order if it is the pro forma or substantially similar and conforming with the pro forma, and grant you safe harbor, and then you can receive service over other transmission systems. Again, it hasn't been, to my knowledge, a barrier to anyone, and a lot of the LPPC utilities that did adopt the pro forma tariff had not followed all the changes because there are some large things in there that are not appealing to most of public power. So some of the subsequent revisions, some very large changes came in Order 890 in 2007. So FERC added this idea of long-term transmission planning, that there were gaps in the ability of third parties to get transmission service because their needs weren't being properly planned for. Conditional firm transmission service and transmission redispatch were ways to try and get better use out of a transmission system, that the incumbent utility kind of knew how to move its resources around to get around constraints, and FERC wanted to make sure that they were doing that for third parties as well, or at least there was the option for third parties to have that sort of service if they were willing to pay for it. Generator imbalance service was recognition that in addition to just moving power over a transmission system for service to load, that when you're wheeling for generators, that puts a cost on a system, and the incumbent utility shouldn't have to bear that on their own. I'll note that conditional firm and generator imbalance were actually both BPA creations that worked well enough that FERC adopted them for everyone else. And finally, I've noted there ATC and business practice posting. So ATC is the available transfer capability. So FERC wants the world to see how much transmission you have available for sale to third parties, and they also want transparency on business practices. So by and large, the idea of open access really is to be open, that you have publicly available information, that your practices are publicly known, and that everyone who might want to use your system has the same ability to do so. Some of these other orders, again, the interconnection processes were developed after the initial tariff, so both for large and small generators. Order 717 governs standards of conduct, and we'll talk about that in more detail. We have a slide just on that. But it relates to how a utility internally can prevent itself from having too advantageous use of its own transmission. Order 1000 is an additional transmission planning process that involves regional transmission. And this is actually a sticking point for a lot of non-jurisdictionals because part of it is mandatory cost allocation between utilities. So if you're a member of a transmission planning region and a project is proposed that may benefit your utility even though you don't own it and may not even be able to access it directly, there is the possibility that you will have to share in the cost of building that project. And so that's, you know, obviously nobody wants to get stuck with costs where they aren't sure they're going to realize the benefits, and it's been a source of contention, not just for non-jurisdictionals, but we at least had a little more flexibility in how we address that regional transmission planning. And finally, just note there that Order 764, which came out in, I think, 2012, covers variable energy resource integration and gave us a lot more system modernization type changes to the tariff. So, for example, 15-minute scheduling instead of the traditional hourly, and some ability to assess additional costs for ancillary services for wind and solar if they're putting additional costs on our system. So a number of changes throughout the years, some very beneficial, some that may not impact us directly as the way our system is set up and operated. So some of the highlights out of the transmission tariff itself, like the interconnection process, it starts with an application. If somebody has interest, we have a formal application process that gets them in line in case anyone else shows up. It's a first come, first serve, generally speaking, setup. Following that, we look at what our available transfer capability is and perform necessary studies. We have to publish not only how much capability we have, but also our methodology for how we determine that. However, it's not straightforward that, for example, if we said we have 500 megawatts of ATC available on the system, that if someone came up with a 100-megawatt request, that we would just subtract that out and 400 left. So depending on location and type of service, there will be perhaps a need for studies. Those are done at customer cost. We obviously will try to use existing studies and base cases, but like with the interconnection process, we do recover our costs from the applicants. And then finally, there is a service agreement, which, unlike the interconnection agreements, we will not be coming to you with a big giant service agreement. Instead, we'll be coming to you with a big giant transmission tariff, and the service agreement just incorporates those terms. And the service agreement itself is really just details for the individual customer. But within the tariff itself, which is incorporated, we cover all the necessary information about the transmission service. So service types, whether it's point-to-point across our system or network integration, which might be, for example, a load on our system or a large generator serving a load on our system, probably some other scenarios, but the customer would select one of those service types, and all the details for how they schedule and our build are set out in the tariff. The service quality, if a customer is taking firm service, which can only be curtailed for system reasons, conditional firm, which gives us a little more flexibility if we didn't have as much space on our system, and the non-firm, which can be curtailed for economic reasons. Tariff addresses rollover rights and competition. Competition was a process set up by FERC so that if we had multiple people requesting transmission service over a particular path or at a particular time, that we can go with the more valuable request, essentially, that the customer asking for a longer duration contract or a contract that starts sooner. I'm probably going to misconstrue a little bit of this, but essentially that we don't have to go just with the person that was initially there if we've got a competing request that is willing to take a more valuable contract. Also, resell and transfer, so that if we get someone that has transmission service and can no longer use it or no longer wishes to use it, we have opportunities to make sure it's still productive, that they can transfer it to another customer. And then finally, because I know this is, it's always important to make sure we have protections for our customer owners, that responsibility for system upgrades is assigned to transmission customers, and we have a stranded cost recovery provision in the tariff as well. It's very broad, not a lot of detail behind it, but it does give us the right to recover stranded costs if that becomes an issue with a transmission customer. So, touching on standards of conduct, This is not actually part of the tariff, but it is required for jurisdictional utilities by the FERC order, and it is a good practice for anyone operating an open access transmission system. Again, this is an element of functional unbundling, so we are making sure that our transmission employees and our marketing employees are not getting their functions crossed in a way that might be unfairly advantageous to us or disadvantageous to our transmission customers. And the essence of standards of conduct is that it prevents unfair advantage in our marketing program due to insider access to transmission information. Since we own the transmission system and since we also employ the marketers, it would be very easy for them to pick up the phone and call and, hey, where are their problems on the system, where are their opportunities, and no one else would have that that ability. And so the standards of conduct process basically has us putting up a wall so that that sort of information doesn't get shared unless it's shared publicly. So non-public information about day-to-day transmission operations is not shared with the wholesale marketing group. It has been revised over the years. Initially, it was very strict. FERC has since revised the policy down to make sure that it's just the wholesale marketers that are being isolated from that information, and it really is just the non-public transmission system information. So this isn't intended to be some sort of barrier to all communications to make life difficult or work more inefficient. And as we've put our policy together, which we borrowed pretty heavily from the BPA policy, they had a really good policy write-up that we used as a starting point. We've tried to be mindful of making sure we don't somehow erect a barrier that's not necessary to achieve this purpose. We still want to have, you know, good communication. We don't want silos. But we do want to make sure that we are being fair to any transmission customers we may have. So our last slide here, our next steps. We're going to finalize these policies and procedures. And by that, I really do mean finalize. We've had kind of our final check-in with senior executive sponsors. We have feedback that just really needs to be incorporated. Document cleaned up and then circulated to internal stakeholders for the final final walkthrough. We're going to come back to you in November to give you a more detailed briefing on the tariff itself, and then we'll come back in December for to ask you for approval of the package. So with that, I will ask him for any final questions, and really happy to answer them.
Thank you, Rob. Commissioners, any questions? I really appreciate how you can clarify a really complex scenario. I mean, your presentation made sense, which that's good. Very good.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Any other questions or comments from commissioners?
Good presentation, no questions.
Well, thank you, Rob.
Thank you. We'll be back next month.
All right. Now, commissioners, I'm looking at my watch, I'm looking at the agenda, and I'm also looking at a bit of inside information that the rest of you don't have. And that is, it's my understanding, we don't need an executive session this afternoon.
That's correct.
Am I correct, Eric?
Yep, you're correct.
Okay. And that being the case, I'd like to suggest we plow right through our agenda and see if we can wrap up by sometime very close to noon because of what's left. Kirk, I don't know how many manager items or the length of the manager items. Do you think we could do that?
I sure think we can. We've got three of them.
Okay. Well, why don't we just continue on our agenda then, and we're at the consent agenda. And this morning, earlier this morning, we moved resolutions 12 through 15 to the consent agenda. So I would entertain a motion to approve the consent agenda.
I would so move.
Is there a second?
Second.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to approve the consent agenda. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The consent agenda has been approved, and we are now to manager items.
Okay. First item is Justin Erickson. I'll give us an update on Riverfront Park.
Thank you, Kirk. Good morning, Commissioners. Justin Erickson, Managing Director for District Services. I'm pleased to provide you just a brief update on public participation with our latest round of feedback from the Riverfront Park planning endeavor. So on September 28th, we held an open house. We did it outside at Pybus, which was a great venue, and the weather really cooperated as well. We had about 100 attendees, which was down a bit from where we were in the middle of the summer, but I think still a pretty good turnout considering that we're back to school and people are busy. But we wanted to, in addition to the open house, we wanted to make sure that people had an opportunity to engage online if they weren't able to attend in person. And so we created a survey that was sort of a virtual open house, if you will, and we left it open for 2 weeks after the actual open house. And we had 700 responses, which was just incredible. I think it's the largest response that, you know, that we've had in some time, probably since the strategic planning process. And I know on the city of Wenatchee side, it far surpassed their expectations in terms of interest. So that was really great to get that kind of feedback. We promoted it on social media, on the district's webpage. And then we also included a notice in the digital packet for the Wenatchee Public School System, which ended up being, I think, really valuable because we hit a different demographic than we were able to during the first open house back in July, and able to get about half of the participation this time was from individuals age 43 and under. And so it was really great to get that diversity in feedback. You might recall from earlier presentations that there were three concepts that were displayed to the public. One was called the play concept, one was the natural or naturalistic concept, and one was the entertainment concept. And we kind of knew going into it that likely folks would be drawn to elements of all three depending upon the specific part of the park that they were viewing. And so we also, through this process, allowed people to kind of pick and choose geographically along the route, which was really good. Overall, the play concept was the most popular, followed by the naturalistic. And so I think what you're going to see likely in this final concept plan will be elements of those two in particular. Large public gatherings and large public events and more commercial development or allowances within or near the park were less popular than those other two options. But in general, you know, strong access for things like beach access, play areas for kids, including an interactive water feature, splash pad, improved viewpoints and gathering spaces and landscaping, and a fair amount of discussion about dogs in the park and the need for additional dog play areas, even though, of course, Hale Park is located just north of Riverfront Park, and that's a city facility, but just a surprising amount of feedback about dogs as well. And then when it came down to the trail, there was a strong preference for a divided trail. Try to have one that was in place for people that were more leisurely enjoying the trail, and then one for those fast e-bikes that you all were discussing at the start of the meeting. And I think that is possible in some of the areas within the park, and in other areas we may have to look at widening the existing trail. But as you can imagine, with the volume of feedback, we're still actually reviewing it. And so I look forward in future meetings to be able to share a more detailed synopsis of the feedback and the specific percentages, et cetera. So just let me wrap this up by telling you next steps. So we are working with the consulting team and the City of Wenatchee and the advisory committee to take all this information and prepare a final preferred concept plan. We're examining phasing options and looking at cost estimates, really trying to see what's feasible and what makes sense, and try to weigh different options for the first phase that we all want to take advantage of in the very near future. And we will be back to you all, hopefully in November or perhaps early December, with a final plan and proposal. I look forward to more discussions. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have at this time as well.
Thank you, Justin. Commissioners, any additional comments or thoughts? I can tell you, Justin, from my wife's and my perspective, one of the things that really, really is appealing at Riverfront Park is the engagement we currently have with WSU Master Gardeners, and if that could get expanded, there's a lot of work of love that goes on there, but that's gorgeous for walking.
I appreciate that. We did ask, as part of the process, we asked the style of landscaping that the public preferred, and the water-wise planting, similar to what's there at WSU, was the preferred option by the public as well. So that area is very, very loved, and I think we can replicate it and add to it elsewhere.
Justin, this is Ann. Wow, that's just that kind of interest and engagement is phenomenal. That's so great. Well, that just demonstrates how much people love their parks. But yeah, you guys did a great job of presenting options. I love the follow-up. That's awesome.
Thank you.
Any other commissioner comments?
I did hear a water feature. Never miss an opportunity.
Dennis, if you weren't going to say anything, I was going to say something.
You've been heard, Dennis. You've been heard. Okay. Any other comments then? Well, thank you, Justin. We look forward to how it's progressing.
Okay. Next item is a supply chain challenge we're keeping a close eye on, and I'll invite Chad Rissman to give you an update on what that is. Are you there, Chad?
He's still on mute, Chad.
There he is. Can't hear your audio, Chad. Well, no worries, Chad. We'll jump to the next one and then come back to you. So with that, I'll turn it over to Ian and John Stoll on a billing issue.
Morning, Commissioners. Can you hear me?
We can hear you fine.
Okay. So last board meeting, I really emphasized our focus on customers, and any technical issue that affects even one customer is actually a big deal for me. And we had an issue last week that John and I have been working with, and I want to present you with some knowledge about it. There's still some work to understand it more thoroughly with some root cause analysis, but the gist of what has occurred, there were two billing systems events that occurred last week. The first happened when re-enabling the late payment charges for customers post-COVID. And if you remember, October 1st, the board decided to reinitialize the late payment charges. And the first process was a technical process to start that process on October 1st, with really the first bills not actually going out until the middle of November. And then we had a second unrelated issue due to a functional process change that actually had a compounding effect on this first issue. So as a result of the re-enabling the late payment charges alone, earlier in the week, we had 1,295 accounts that were inappropriately applied to late payment charge. But the issue was actually discovered and the bill print file was actually pulled before any customers were affected or any bills were sent. Unfortunately, the second issue that resulted Wednesday morning during a process, it created a bad bill print file. And because of this, it accidentally picked up the bill file that had been pulled because it couldn't create a new bill file. And that bill file was sent to our billing system, FIS. As a result, 124 of these accounts were inadvertently billed with an erroneous late payment charge. The result right now is that we've had 124 customers that received this erroneous bill and were impacted by the late payment charges. They are receiving a second bill with the correct amount. However, that means they now have two bills, one incorrect and one correct. Some of these customers are receiving them through a paper process. Some have actually received them through an email immediately on the process. In addition, the other 2,000 plus, was it 1,295 accounts, also had second bills sent, although both bills were correct bills. They were receiving two bills instead. Again, some of these are both in email form and some in paper form. As a result, John's team, the customer service, is reaching out to the customers, making them aware of the billing challenges that we had last week, and what is the correct bill and the correct amount to pay. And John can probably talk to you a little bit about that. What I do want to say is that both the functional team in customer utilities and in IT, the technical team, are going through a root cause analysis. We're trying to understand what occurred, what should have occurred, what are the processes that we can put in place or procedures we can put in place to make sure that this does not happen again, identify those lessons learned, and really figure out where we can make improvements within the district and on the technology side. With that, John, do you have anything to add on the customer outreach?
Thanks, Ian. That was a very thorough overview, and I appreciate the collaboration work through this. As Ian stated, it was about 2,900 bills that went out. The 124 that one was correct, one was incorrect. That's the focus, to ensure that people know what is the right amount to pay. The other ones will be more of a customer irritant, receiving two bills. Interesting enough, 51% of those bills are e-bills, so essentially they got two emails. The other ones will be hard copy bills. So again, our call center, our customer relation folks, will be willing to just explain that should a customer call. But again, the focus is to make sure those folks who receive two bills, one incorrect, one correct, know what is the correct amount.
Any, thank you for that update. That's you know, upfront acknowledgement and reaching out to the customer is, you know, recognition that mistakes do get made, and hopefully they won't be repeated. And that's what you're working on, and that's good. So thank you.
And we should have more information available in the process that Ian described too, looking at the root cause.
Yeah, we'll finish up that process in the next couple days, and we'll present it to Kirk and Steve, and we'll let them present that to you. So,
Dennis, I saw you unmute.
Yeah, I just wanted to share a little bit of a good news email that I received during the week related to customer service. George Wilson, you know, like when they actually had to have his mirror pulled to do some work, and just his response to our crews and our staff's attentiveness, timeliness of service, and the courtesy and enthusiasm that our staff dealt with he and his wife, just related to that issue. It was very complimentary, and I forwarded it to the people that he wanted to forward it to, but I also felt that it was worthy of recognition, you know, for our customer service staff and our personnel that were involved. So thanks to everyone for a very positive response to a customer who's very appreciative. So thank you.
Okay. Thank you for that update. So,
okay, ready
any
to go.
Other questions, commissioners? Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, I think we're ready to try Chad Rissman again.
Audio check.
Sounds good, Chad. Thank you.
Hey, look at there. Rebecca told me to Control Alt Delete, so I did that, and I'm back. Good morning, commissioners. I think we've heard a lot about this topic, not only at Chelan PUD, but everywhere, supply chain issues. So I wanted to bring to the board's attention a particular area that we're concerned about, which is distribution transformers. We're seeing impacts in just about everything over the last year plus. Our warehousing group and our purchasing staff and our engineers and operations have done quite a bit that I won't get into the details of putting together contingency plans, looking at alternatives, alternative suppliers. Now, essentially, everything is we haven't been too impacted by most things. The costs are going up, sometimes 50%, and the delivery dates are way out. So, you know, we've bumped up some of our orders. We're ordering things sooner. We're recognizing that the costs are going up in several areas. But there's one area that I wanted to highlight, and that's our distribution transformers. One of the things that's a little bit different about a distribution transformer is manufacturers and factories, these are build to order. So they're really, they don't run necessarily a lot of these and then store them and warehouse them. They're ordered, or they're built as ordered. And so they're scheduling factory times. And I think we're all familiar with what's going on with factories and supply, so they're challenged too. The other side of that is demand. Our transformer usage for new services and the growth and things that we've got going on, and our improvement projects that we've got going on the system. So when we're rebuilding lines, expanding fiber, we're also replacing assets. And so our use of transformers have gone up. So those two things combined have got us down to critical transformer levels at the point where we're wanting to hold our few transformers that we have left for emergencies only, which is going to ultimately impact new services. We've got several things in place. The challenge we're having right now and what's got us at this point is our primary supplier, who we have got a contract with, is their delivery dates continue to push out and our orders are getting reduced. So we're working with other vendors and manufacturers. We're looking at the used market. We're refurbishing some of our own. We also have several transformers in our system that we're looking at that are at least reported from our billing system that they're underutilized. We'll be looking at shifting and moving some of those things around. Anyway, there's a litany of things that we're putting in place and doing, but at this point right now, we're at critical inventory levels, but we understand that that's going to likely have an impact on customer connection. So we're developing a communications plan around that and some outreach. We're going to be asking our customers to work very closely with the customer service engineer so that we can understand their particular impact to their project that they have going on. Not every new service requires a new transformer. A lot of services utilize existing infrastructure that's in place. So your particular connection may not require a transformer. But to work with your customer service engineer. So looking forward to putting some additional contingencies in place. One of the things that there's been some discussions about, we've identified some other manufacturers and suppliers that have a few units available. One of the avenues for purchasing those units or their factory space might be to have ourselves declare an emergency, so that we can lock those in But we'll be evaluating that over the next couple of weeks, and it's possible that we might be coming to the board if there's support for doing something like that, at least to give us a little bit of contingency. That's obviously not practice. We do have a contract in place that was a bid contract, and we will be continuing to work with that supplier. They're not happy with the situation they're in either, so I think everybody's experiencing this. So at that, I'll stop and open up for any questions.
Questions, commissioners?
Yes, Mr. President. Chad, yeah. I have a question. What's the shelf life on one of those transformers if we had it and sitting around?
Yeah, there is a long shelf life of those. So there's some advantages here with these transformers. Is we know that they will get used. They're somewhere between, they're a few thousand dollars. So before, some of them now are $4,000 for a smaller, generally used transformer, but historically those have been $1,000. So the cost per unit is not really very much. So when you think about shelf lives and things, you know, you'd have to take that into consideration. But so I think that puts us in a position where if we bumped up our inventory levels, you know, they would get used. It's not like something that would be a loss.
So when you say a shelf life's a long time, is it 5 years?
The transformers in service have a service life up to 30 to 30 plus years. And with no load on the transformer, they probably they're still in good condition 10 years. So okay. We have transformers in our inventory. Well, not right now, but we usually have a pretty good transformer inventory. They've just continued to dwindle.
So what is our normal transformer average inventory?
So we use about 150 a year. And we try to keep, you know, several dozen units of the ones that we use a lot in our inventory. Manufacturing used to be 8 to 10 weeks after order. It's 12 to 30 weeks now. When we receive the units, they go through a series of performance testing. And we wouldn't want our crews to energize those things there, unless they've been tested. So in order to get them ready for issuing, there's quite a bit of testing and benchmarking. They're oil till devices, so we got a lot of cradle to grave responsibilities with those. So getting them actually into inventory and ready for use does take a bit of time.
So one last question, and then I'll be quiet. But what would you recommend as, or, you know, what would staff recommend as, if we were going to increase inventory, what kind of number are they thinking? Are they thinking 50, 60, 80?
Yeah, well, we're having those discussions right now, and I think we'll come up with a plan. Personally, if we had 50% of what we would use annually, and maybe we get that through various manufacturers, and we keep our current orders in place, at least that would set us up for a position to be able to continue to provide our customers an important new service and things. So knowing, as your question before, that these transformers, they're not going to age, and they'll still be used, we will use them. Don't see a lot of downside to bumping up our inventory other than the upfront costs associated with that.
I was thinking same way. Thank you.
Any other questions for Chad? Well, we look forward to seeing how we can work through this. Every news media outlet in the country has been focused on those container ships sitting at the ports, you know, and so we know there's a supply chain issue right now. May take another year to sort out. Okay, Kirk.
Yeah, certainly more to come on that one. That's all we have for manager items.
All right. Well, we've just got a few items left here, probably 5 or 10 minutes. Commission items, we've got a couple. Every year we have a son or daughter of one of our employees as a potential recipient of the PUD Association scholarship, and the rules of conduct on how we do that is we are to draw a name out of a hat, so to speak. And I guess today it might be drawing a name out of an orange bag, so to speak. If you'll check your screen, Rebecca is shaking the bag. I've asked Rebecca if she would do the honors today.
Sean is holding the bag
again.
And we have a name.
Samuel Reese Hildebrand. Great.
Okay, so Samuel's name is going to be entered in the Wapuda Scholarship list, and we will know more after our now to be held virtual annual conference. We also have a motion. I don't know if anybody has it before them. To set a tri-commission meeting. Anybody have that in front of them?
I do. Oh, wait. I take it back.
Well, what I could do is I could read this and ask if somebody would make that motion. So we need to move to set a special meeting on Tuesday, November 30, 2021 at 1 p.m., be held virtually for the purpose of holding a tri-commission meeting. Virtual meeting information will be posted on the PUD website. Somebody willing to make that motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move to set a special meeting as described by Chairman Randy Smith.
Is there a second?
I'll second.
Been moved and seconded to set the date with the special meeting. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Opposed? Motion is carried. Is there any other commissioner items before I move on to delegation? Commissioner Congdon.
Thank you. I have something of interest, I believe. I heard from Peggy Whitmore in Antioch. She's a very civic-minded gal. She's served on a number of different PUD committees, ad hoc committees. Anyway, she and her board have done a lot of work on the Antioch Museum over the years. I think it was originally started by her grandfather, I believe. But anyway, she asked if I wanted to tour the museum, and I said, sure, I'd love to. So I did that. The museum sits on PUD Park property in Antioch on the north end of the park. It's a beautiful setting. It's surrounded with grass, and it goes right down to the river. And she is just interested in kind of furthering their, furthering their plan, if you could call it that, for the museum. So she's going to have, or she told me that they're going to have a function there in either April or May. I think it's April 21st, and it's going to center around Native American history and Antioch, also the three towns of Antioch. And I suggested, and she's going to invite all the commissioners. We'll hear more about that later. But I just wanted to let you know, I know Dennis is particularly interested in history. It's very interesting. I went through it. It sits in a small house. This house was built in 1885, and this is the only original or the oldest original house that still sits in Antioch, because, you know, there have been three different towns, and they have no heat. They have no internet access, but it's very interesting, and they have a really wonderful display chronicling the three different towns of Antioch and how that all came down, of course, because of the inundation of water from Rocky Beach Dam. So I just wanted to give you guys a little heads up and give you some background on that. She's just, you know, wanting to get together and talk about where do we go from here. They don't own the land. They don't own the building that the museum sits in. So they can't really apply for grants. They can't do a lot to enlarge or improve their, you know, their present situation. So we'll proceed from there. But I think she may have called Dennis. Have you talked with her, Dennis?
No, I have not.
No. Okay. Yeah. I think probably she will be contacting
sure.
you. So that's just an FYI for everybody.
Thank you, Ann. You probably already know that Antioch holds a soft spot in my heart for me because the impact that our dam had on that community and how many of my contemporaries have shared with me how the impacted their very livelihood. So,
It does me too. And they have so much pride in their community and they've rebuilt, like I said, three times. And I know also, Randy, I know you loved that mural that was on the wall.
Yes. Yes.
At the school.
School cafeteria. They can never tear that down.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, you'll be hearing more.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you.
You bet. Any other commission items? Item 18 is follow-up on delegation of items from the previous board meeting.
We had a couple items. One of them was for Steve to provide liquidity forecast for 2017 through 2021 for comparison to the current forecast, and I believe that was shared by email from Kelly Boyd on October 6th. And then we also had another one for Bob Shane to provide current cost per premise per mile on the fiber extension, both urban and outlying areas. And I don't know if that's been provided. I don't think it has been provided yet, unless you've all received that. Nope. Okay. I know he's working on it.
Kurt, this is Bob Shane. I have not finished that, but commissioners, you'll be seeing that here this week for sure.
Thank you.
Those were the two items from the last board meeting.
And any from this meeting, delegation?
We don't have any. We don't have any unless you have some.
I don't believe so.
Okay.
So at this time, if there's any public on the line, is there any additional public comment? Hearing none, are there any other matters of business that necessarily need to come before the commission? If not, we will stand adjourned.